Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
All right, move along. Nothing to see here, folks. The Fed's not buying bonds anymore. Fine, great. But the stimulus, oh, she ain't dead. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 29th of October, Wednesday, or as it's known on Wall Street, the first day of the rest of our lives without the Federal Reserve throwing money at us. Right on schedule today, Janet Yellen and her colleagues on the Federal Open Market Committee said they are going to stop adding to their big bond buying program. Quantitative easing is the phrase that you have come to know and love. The Fed did have generally good things to say about the health of the American economy. Growth is stronger. The labor market is healing, albeit slowly. Also, interestingly, they are not as worried about persistently low inflation as they used to be. That's important. And all of the foregoing is good. Two quick points, however, about today's decision before we move on. A, just because the Fed stopped buying bonds doesn't mean they can't start again, you know. C, also QE1 and QE2. This latest one was QE3. Also, B, despite all the headlines, it is not actually true that the Fed has, and I'm using air quotes here, ended their stimulus. Yes, they are not buying new bonds anymore, but the $4.5 trillion worth of bonds they already bought are still on the books. All that liquidity, in other words, is still out there. All right, moving on, because the American economy is more than what 10 people sitting around a big conference table in Washington, D.C. say it is. It is, in very large measure, what you say it is. And we've been asking the past couple of weeks for you to tell us what your economy is like. Today, Catherine Eleloof from Miami, Florida.
My personal economy is painful and bleak. I'm a public school teacher and can't find a job because too many have been laid off in my county. I lost my husband to cancer and then lost my home, a 5-bedroom, 3-bath on almost 3 acres. I have 2 children in college and I am completely broke. My youngest son has Medicaid and we both receive food assistance. But I have no health insurance coverage. One of the ways I'm trying to make ends meet is to work as a substitute teacher. Of course, many other teachers are working as substitute teachers. And even if I did get a phone call every day to go teach, I would not be allowed. Substitute teachers in our county are only allowed to work 4 out of 5 days a week. Otherwise, we would be considered full-time employees, and they would have to give us benefits and health insurance. I know now that I will probably never be able to retire. I will probably have to work until the day that I can no longer work. And I hope and I pray that I will not be a financial burden on my children at that point. I was valedictorian of my high school, graduated college cum laude, traveled all over South America, learned 2 new languages, married, raised 2 wonderful young citizens. However, in the meantime, I'm very close to being homeless. Some people simply can put the poor out of their mind thinking, well, that's not me, that's not anyone I know that's struggling that badly. Well, I never dreamed I'd be in the situation that I am today.
Catherine Eleloof from Miami, Florida. The question, just to refresh your memory, is what is your economy like? You can tell us at marketplace.org. Maybe we'll put you on the radio. On Wall Street today, as he makes an awkward segue, things were fine. The Fed decision was already priced in, as the cool kids like to say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'd give you today's close for crude oil on the New York Mercantile Exchange, but that's kind of become a cop-out way for me to start an oil story. So how about we just get right to it instead, okay? The oil boom in this country is creating a whole lot of wealth for people, but also for governments. Think Texas and North Dakota. The question is, what do you do with that wealth? Do you spread the good times around? And if so, how? Ohio is in the middle of that debate right now. The Republican governor there wants to raise taxes on oil and gas. Sounds curious, the GOP raising taxes, right? But if you step back for a second, it's really not. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
If you visit the oil and gas fields of Ohio, you see trucks with license plates from Texas and logos of firms based in Oklahoma. One reason Ohio Governor John Kasich wants to raise oil and gas taxes is to keep the money at home. Here's Ohio State economist Mark Partridge.
He views this as some sort of a ripoff, that these energy resources are transported out of the state of Ohio, used and refined in other places, and all the profit and wealth goes to these other places, and it leaves Ohio.
By most measures, Ohio's taxes on energy production are low, less than 1% compared to 7% in Texas and 25% in Alaska. Kasich wants to raise them to nearly 3% or higher. Drillers say that'll drive them away to low-tax states, except that hasn't happened historically. Michael Levy is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
The decisions about where to drill are ultimately not going to be determined by comparing different states. They're going to be determined on a location-by-location basis on whether a profit can be made.
Governments that tax oil and gas use the money in different ways. Some sock it away for future generations. Others spend it on roads hurt by the drilling or in education. Kasich of Ohio wants to cut taxes, which spreads the energy wealth. But Mark Haggerty at Headwaters Economics worries that makes the state budget more dependent on taxes from fossil fuels, a boom and bust sector.
And in fact, what you're doing is actually creating a less stable tax base for the state going forward into the future.
And the future is the whole question, how to take today's riches and plant them in the right place. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
All right, I can't help myself. $82.20 a barrel was the close for crude in New York today. Facebook earnings came out yesterday, which I think we covered for you. The key word was billion. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO and the founder, said the B word 14 times in his call with investors. There was $3.2 billion. That's revenue this quarter. There's 1 billion video views, a new milestone. And perhaps most importantly, there is 1 billion users. That's what Facebook itself already has. And it's the goal that Zuckerberg is setting for a whole bunch of Facebook-owned products, from Instagram to WhatsApp. That's a cool billion users before Facebook tries to turn them, and this is Zuckerberg's word, into meaningful businesses. So Stan Alcorn asks, what's in a billion anyways?
Here's what Zuckerberg said.
This may sound a little ridiculous to say, but for us, products don't really get that interesting to turn into businesses until they have about a billion people using them.
It sounds a little ridiculous to me as well.
Nate Elliott is an analyst at Forrester Research. He says Facebook itself didn't become a great business until it had a billion users.
And I wonder if they're not using that as the benchmark for everything else they do.
But to understand why that benchmark is, in Zuckerberg's words, ridiculous, you have to appreciate just how big a billion is. To do that, I called up my high school math teacher, Don Smith.
It's an incomprehensible number, Stan. It really is.
To picture it, consider an inch.
A billion inches is over 15,000 miles.
A billion users? That's 120 times the population of New York City. Roger Kay at Endpoint Technology Associates says to get that many people, you usually have to look at whole industries.
For example, the toilet paper market is pretty universal, but nonetheless, it's not a single supplier.
There are a handful of businesses that sell physical products to a billion people, Procter & Gamble, Unilever, Coca-Cola. But Facebook has the advantage of a product it gives away for free, which it can do because it's digital.
So how many accounts do you want to set up? You know, as many as you want.
The disadvantage of a free product is you only make money by selling ads. This quarter, Facebook made about $2.37 in revenue for each of its 1.35 billion users. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
We are, what, 6 days from the midterm elections, right? There was some chatter as the campaigns began, lo those many months ago, that this was going to be the year politics went digital, that online campaign ads were the wave of the future. And they may well be, but anybody living in a state with a tight race can tell you that it ain't going to be this year. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Gender explains why television advertising has so much political staying power.
Evan Tracy is on the front lines of the political ad wars, feeding ammunition to the candidates. Tracy is senior vice president at National Media Research, Planning and Placement, a Republican consulting firm in a renovated warehouse just outside Washington. It looks like a tech startup, all exposed brick and black metal stairways. Tracy shows me around.
Basically a full-service production suite that...
It's pumping out TV commercials. Tracy advises candidates, buy as much TV advertising as you can. Ignore those people who say TV is dead.
If the predictions of TV being dead are true, then it's being buried in money.
Tracy says, sure, TV audiences are aging, but older people vote, and TV ads can work with online ads to catch younger voters who watch TV with smartphone in hand.
So if I can have my voice and pictures on your TV screen and have my digital ad on your smartphone, I've gotten you two ways now.
Plus, TV can be targeted more than ever now. Cable set-top boxes tell campaigns exactly what you're watching. They figure out what your favorite shows are and advertise on them. But Tracy says it's still best to use TV as an old-fashioned megaphone, blanketing the airwaves till there's no escape.
But yes, some of these states right now are just, you know, they're seeing thousands of ads a day.
States like Iowa, where Barbara Trish lives.
It's been really hard to watch TV without being bombarded with advertisements.
Actually, Trish doesn't mind. She loves campaign ads, even studies them as a professor of political science at Grinnell College. One of her favorites features a candidate who compares castrating hogs to cutting pork in Washington.
Let's make them squeal.
Trish agrees that TV is still king of campaign ads, but for a different reason. Candidates, parties, and outside groups are pouring cash into the midterm elections, and it needs a home.
But it's just that there's so much money out there. It seems like they feel like it has to be spent on something. You've got to put it to use.
There's a lot of money sloshing around Colorado, too, where there are close Senate and gubernatorial races and lots of ads focused on women's issues, big government.
We've got to keep our eye on government.
Floyd Cerulli is a pollster in Denver. He's head of Cerulli Associates, and he's getting sick of all the ads. In fact, he's been predicting the dethroning of TV since the early 2000s, banging the drum about how candidates will go digital and look for other ways to reach voters. But even he admits when it comes to TV,
it's still the king.
Cerulli says blanket TV advertising can gain a campaign a few points in the polls. That could push a candidate over the top in Colorado.
But it's going to be close, and so a couple of percentage points can make the difference.
Cerulli says TV's crown will start to slip eventually, but it's firmly in place for the foreseeable future. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I've always had a fascination with numbers and with business, despite, I don't know, it's like a weird foreign thing to me to pay attention to.
And get this, he runs a company. But first, let's do the numbers. As I said, priced in, the Fed move was. Dow Industrials gave up 31 points today, a 10th percent, finished at 16,974. The NASDAQ off 15 points, that's about a third of 1%, 45.49. The S&P 500 edged down 2 points. Call that a 10th percent, 1982. That space station rocket that exploded, shares of its maker Orbital Sciences Corporation fell 16% today. Over at American Realty Capital Properties, the company's accounting blew up. American Realty said its financial statements going back a year aren't reliable. Shares off 5% today. Some private equity firms were expected to bid for PetSmart, one of those stores where far too many people are buying Halloween costumes for their dogs this week. Yeah, PetSmart up 2.3% for the day. Woof. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at the events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues its advance estimate for third quarter gross domestic product. Starbucks announces quarterly earnings. And get caffeinated for this event in Los Angeles' Little Tokyo. Hello Kitty Con 2014 gets underway in honor of her 40th anniversary. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. During his 20-some-odd years as a professional tennis player, Andre Agassi won 8 Grand Slam singles titles. Since he retired in 2006, he's been heavily involved in education philanthropy, charter schools specifically. The last couple of years, though, his business model has changed a bit. Agassi has joined the growing number of investors who see public education as a revenue stream, education real estate, to be more specific here. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer has the story.
The second graders in this charter school classroom in Nashville were barely born when Andre Agassi hung up his tennis racket, so they don't really know much about the guy with the shaved head touring their new school.
What made you want to play tennis?
I never really wanted to.
Agassi says his dad made him play tennis. Turns out he was pretty good.
And then all of a sudden, when I won, I had a chance to build my own school.
The irony is not lost on him. Since Agassi dropped out of school himself, he's since raised $100 million to supplement public funding for a charter school in his hometown of Las Vegas. But in the last few years, he teamed up with investors to start a hedge fund. They don't run schools. They just buy the land, finance construction, then rent the school back to a charter, typically part of a national chain like Kipp Academy or Rocket Ship.
Especially people who are skeptics of the charter movement will look at this and say, look at these folks who are lining their pockets by building schools for charters. What's been your response to that?
Well, first of all, that's actually the first time it's been actually brought up. I thought about it 1,000 times heading into this adventure.
But given the struggle to finance his own charter school, Agassi says he's decided charity has limitations.
I don't believe personally that philanthropy is scalable.
Agassi's charter school real estate venture certainly satisfies a need. School founders almost universally struggle to find adequate facilities. Often school districts are reluctant to rent out vacant school buildings to charters, who are sometimes seen as competitors. They occasionally have to locate in less than ideal learning environments like a renovated strip mall. The pitch from Agassi's investors is, let us build you a school. You focus on teaching, and if you want to buy the building from us in a few years, great. Santa Monica-based investor Bobby Turner helped get Agassi on board.
If you want to treat a problem in society, philanthropy is fine. But if you want to cure, really cure, you need to harness market forces to create a sustainable solution. That means making money, because only then is it scalable. And by the way, there's no rule book that says you can't make money and make societal change at the same time. They're symbiotic.
It kind of makes my stomach turn.
Brett Bymaster is a parent in San Jose, where the Agassi Turner Fund has been active. He's taken it upon himself to dig into their business model, though one can only dig so far. While they're building public charter schools, there's very little public information, including what they charge their tenants. Often the school has to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
We need to partner with people outside, but I don't think that the solutions to my community involve one percenters getting filthy rich.
Bymaster wonders what happens to one of these buildings if the charter has to shut down, and many do. So far, all 39 schools built by the fund are still up and running. A spokesman says if one closed, the building could be rented to another charter operator. Even among charter school advocates, there is some quiet suspicion of partnering with hedge funds. First, there's cost. One charter founder said a deal with Agassi was 25% above any other option. Jessica Johnson leads the Colorado-based Charter Schools Facilities Initiative and doesn't take a position on for-profit investors.
I mean, I know of many instances where it's worked out really well, and I know of others that, you know, there's been challenges.
Johnson says plenty of charter schools have had trouble working with nonprofits, too. That's why she cautions everyone to read the fine print, no matter who's helping them build their school. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
As I said in the numbers, and as you have no doubt heard and quite probably seen by now, an unmanned rocket ferrying supplies to the International Space Station blew up just after liftoff yesterday. Nobody was hurt, and the 6 people living in space right now are going to be just fine. But the space business model is worth a look. Kate Davidson has it.
In 2008, NASA was preparing to retire the space shuttle, so it hired two private companies to resupply the space station, Orbital Sciences, whose rocket just exploded, and the company known as SpaceX. The initial price tag was $3.5 billion. Frank Slazer with the Aerospace Industries Association says NASA wasn't buying new vehicles.
What they actually bought was cargo delivery services, just like you would buy services on FedEx or something like that.
Yesterday's explosion may prompt concern over the increasing privatization of space travel, but space people say, remember, NASA has always relied on the private sector.
NASA's never built a rocket. Rockets that NASA and the Air Force use have always been built by private companies.
John Logsdon founded the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. He doesn't think the explosion says anything profound about this model of business.
What it says is launching things into space is hard. And there will be, unfortunately, failures along the way.
NASA recently hired Boeing and SpaceX to ferry astronauts to the space station in a few years. It's all part of NASA's attempts to reach its goals more cheaply. At the same time, Carissa Christensen with the Torrey Group says the commercial space industry has grown globally. It's now worth about $225 billion.
Putting that in context, the total amount that governments spend globally is about $75 billion.
NASA's now in the process of awarding its next round of cargo contracts. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Our live roadshow, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers, was in New York City a couple of weeks ago, the 92nd Street Y, in fact, where we talked to, among others, Yancey Strickler, the newish CEO and one of the co-founders of Kickstarter. So here you go with the numbers. 71,000 projects on Kickstarter, plus or minus $1 billion donated by 7.2 million people overall. I started that night on stage, as one might reasonably do, by asking him how Kickstarter started. Turns out he was at a restaurant talking to his waiter, who became his co-founder, a guy by the name of Perry Chen.
Perry was an artist and someone who had a lot of interesting ideas, and he had this thought about creating a system where he could propose an idea to the world and people would support it if they wanted to, but no one would be charged unless everyone thought it was a good idea. And also, because I was thinking about numbers, it was 900 days after he told me about the idea that we managed to launch the site. So
three and a half years.
So it took a while.
We had you on Marketplace 2.5 years ago when you were not yet the guy running the company, right? Mm-hmm. We were talking backstage and you were talking about how, you know, you've got 100 people counting on you now. I wonder how your life has changed now that you are the guy responsible for the numbers, almost literally.
Yeah, it's interesting. So there, you know, three of us who started it. I don't know. I did customer service when we first began. I was always the friendly person who'd go shake everybody's hand and talk to creators all day, and that's just kind of how I enjoy life. Beginning of this year, my partner Perry stepped up to become chairman and to go back to being a full-time artist, and I became CEO. I've always had a fascination with numbers and with business, despite, I don't know, it's like a weird foreign thing to me to pay attention to. But this year I have
We should totally not tell the people who work at Kickstarter that it's a foreign thing for you.
They could tell. Actually having to understand that and become really deep with it has become a new thing for me this year, although that isn't the biggest challenge at all. I mean, What's the biggest challenge? It's the weight of the 7 million people who have backed a project before, probably some of whom are in this audience. And it's the weight of trying to lead something that we believe can inspire a new creative golden age. It's phenomenal and incredibly difficult.
It occurs to me there is not actually a moment when you as a CEO can stop worrying, right?
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Definitely not.
I wonder how you, as an entrepreneur, in the beginning, explained something that didn't exist. Here's this idea we have where we go out and ask people for money. How'd you do that?
Yeah, it was terrible. It was terrible, but I now view it as a real privilege. You know, we for 4 years went around pitching people on this idea that really had no analog whatsoever. And we met a lot of very prominent investors who every single one of them told us no. And then when it becomes a real thing, It's even weirder. I mean, it was on, Kickstarter was on South Park 2 weeks ago. They did a whole episode about Kickstarter. And I got so many texts and emails from old friends that were like, whoa, dude, that thing you did was on South Park. Holy which is honestly exactly the same way that I feel about it. I mean, I completely concur.
Yancey Strickler, ladies and gentlemen, Kickstarter. The next and final stop for the national tour of How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers is right here in Los Angeles. Next Saturday, it's November the 8th, me on stage with some people in the business of creativity, Amy Poehler, Norman Lear, Gwen Shotwell from SpaceX. Tickets at marketplace.org if you're in town. Come on by.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This final note on the way out today, somehow appropriate as the Fed stops buying bonds to help the economy recover from its worst disaster since the Great Depression. You could say that depression started on this day 85 years ago, Black Tuesday, October the 29th, 1929, the start of the crash. Interesting tidbit for the history buffs among you, the volume on the New York Stock Exchange that day, the number of shares trading hands set a record not broken for 40 years. And they were trading them all by hand, by the way. None of that electronic trading stuff we see today. Speaking of trading, the Dow gave up 31 points on this Wednesday. That's a 10%. The NASDAQ off 15 points, a 3rd percent. The S&P 500 dropped itself 2 points lower, a 0.1%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lentz, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.